Good afternoon. I'm going to call this meeting of the State Government and Veterans Budget Division to order for Thursday, February 27, 2014. It's about 10 minutes after 3. We don't have a quorum quite yet, but we're getting pretty close, and I appreciate you members that are here. I also appreciate the fact that we can welcome back Senator Anderson and Senator Dames, and we have a new member replacing Senator Rest, Senator Carlson. We appreciate you joining our committee, and look forward to having you here.
He's Mr. Chair.
Yes.
As I understand, he says he's every bit as knowledgeable as she is.
Yeah, so right.
Sure. Yeah.
But yeah,
we just wanted to raise the bar quite.
Well, and Senator Carlson, I didn't mean that in a derogatory manner. It's just we're hoping you aren't quite as well. No, I'm
just. I'll be whatever you want me to be.
All right. Very good. Ann was a great committee member, but we're happy to have
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
Today we're going to have four reviews: the Secretary of State, the Department of Revenue, the Legislative Coordinating Commission with the Office of Legislative Audit, and finally review for a minute. And the scope of these reviews, we're going to have testifiers come up, normally the head of those agencies, and give a brief update on the first year's expenditures from the budget that we passed last year. Where they're headed in the second year, any unisession items that they may think that we're interested in and feel this division should hear. And so with that, we have the Secretary of State, the Honorable Mark Ritchie, with us this morning. And this afternoon, excuse me. It was a long morning. And we're looking forward to your presentation, Mr. Secretary, and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Mark Ritchie. I have the honor of serving all of you as your Secretary of State. And thank you for this opportunity to give you a brief update and kind of a little overview of where we are kind of midway through this biennium. To remind you, our office is largely business services. We usually say around two-thirds. The second largest part is, of course, elections. That's perhaps the best known. Public engagement, all the things that we do with the open enrollment process and the appointments and everything else that we do. And then Safe at Home, a program that was passed back in 2006. We were tasked then with implementing it, and it's a address confidentiality program. So that's roughly how our staff and budget is divided up. We are generating a surplus for you in the general fund, about $14 million each year. Certain of the fees charged for some of the business services go directly into the general fund, and you very generously give us a portion of those back to us in our budget. So the business services part, which generates that revenue, although there is a tiny bit of revenue from candidate filings, but not enough to really talk about, new business filings have been on a steady climb, at least in my 7 years now, a pretty steady climb. Last year we were up a little bit over 58,000. It was, again, up 17.5% from 10 years ago. It's the third highest on record. We are looking like this year will exceed that. Those are the new entities that are being created who choose to file with our office. Now, some individuals creating new businesses are working solely under their own name. They do not have to file with us, although some do. And then, of course, there are some businesses who choose to file in Delaware. It does not make us happy. We're constantly competing with them, and we're working hard to keep them here. But 60,000 puts us way ahead on a per capita basis of all the states around us, significantly ahead of Iowa and Wisconsin and other similar states. So we have filings of about 300,000 that are current. So every year we have about 300,000 businesses that we work with and roughly 60,000 new ones that come in.
Excuse me, Mr. Secretary, we have a quorum. At,
thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this is just to give you a sense of that increase of new business filings. You can see it's a pretty steady rise. Of course, we had the tough 2008, 2009, 2010 kind of downturn. You can see it peaked and then went down, and it's headed back up. But that's what we do. Two-thirds of our staff are involved in the whole business services side. Filings are the thing that fuel that each and every year. Been a few key developments in this last period, especially in the last year, but this obviously takes more than that. We've been in a seven-year process of digitizing all of our business services so that no matter where you lived in the state, you could have access to our services. You didn't have to drive into St. Paul or use a courier service or something to that effect. And we are very near done. This last piece of that puzzle, the Uniform Commercial Code, and the CNS, the Central Notification Service, which is largely for crop loans and livestock loans, that system is in our quality assurance testing now. And by the end of the year, that piece will be completed. 90-some percent of our filings then will be online and available. And this has had many other benefits, lowering costs for people, et cetera. That's given us the ability to then strengthen our digital security. Based on the experience of other states, we've been able to add some passcode protections and other things. So this has been a good benefit of becoming digital. And it's allowed us to be more proactive. For example, the Department of Transportation wanted to reach more veteran-owned businesses. They asked us if we knew of our 60,000 each year, our 300,000 and some, who were veteran-owned. We said no, but we have the capacity to ask, and in response to the question, are you a veteran-owned business, would you like to be in contact with and receive information from the Department of Transportation? If so, click here. Over 1,500 businesses responded. About 1,200 of those wanted to be put in touch with other services, and the Department of Transportation did an excellent job of standing up workshops all over the state to give those people who responded, those veteran-owned businesses, the information they needed to now. I believe there's now over 100 of those who successfully bid. So we have used the digital platform that we've created now for some new and innovative things, and there's a lot more of that to do. We've done a similar thing now with the new Viking Stadium. And finally, we're able to use our digital information in partnership with people like, some of you remember, Representative King Banyan, an economist at St. Cloud State. He's been using our data for 15 years to do the regional forecast for what they call Central Minnesota, for that St. Cloud region. But now with the digital format, he's able to take that that skill and that expertise and be able to apply that in our other regions around the state. So we have a partnership with Dr. Banyan and St. Cloud State to do that. But that's because we now have digital access to our information. It makes a big difference. Electronic filings, which have resulted, save us money. Some of you know our biggest customer is John Deere. When somebody buys a tractor or combine on time or with a lien or loan, they register that with us. So if that combine is put forward as collateral for some other loan, the bank checks with us, our office, and it's recorded. They were formerly doing a little over 11,000 by paper, a very laborious process for them and us. John Deere, their computer people and our computer people worked. It took about 2 years to build a system that would talk, where the computers could talk, and we took it down to zero paper and all electronic. It saved John Deere a lot of money, and it is, of course, allowed us to free up a person who can be at the counter helping people who need help. Having the computers talking to each other when it's appropriate frees up people to talk to people when that's needed. Election administration, again, is the smaller part of the big things we do, but we stay pretty busy. The legislature gave us a couple assignments last year, electronic roster pilot project, which was the testing of some models of electronic rosters in polling places. Those are the little poll books or little computers that can be used alongside of or in substitute for the paper rosters. We did that. You'll have a report You already have a report on that. Electronic roster task force. We had a task force of motor vehicles and local election officials and others. You have a report from that task force and recommendation for some next steps in terms of taking that pilot and looking at an economic analysis to see if this makes sense. Can this save money for the local community while giving us more secure elections and a better service to our customers? We've developed a lot of expanded data matching with our Department of Corrections, being able to use their computer system and our computer system to give us a cleaner list. The townships now, and for a number of years, have had the right to have all mail ballot, all U.S. Postal Service balloting. Over 500 had made that choice. The townships requested that we build a tracking system to make that easier for them. And the legislature also expanded the ability or the right of townships of any size to use that U.S. Postal Service delivery system. So that's been completed, and it will be in use this year in this year's election. Again, enhanced data protection. We're all learning as we go along how clever are the hackers and those who want to take down systems for nefarious purposes or just to be ornery. We've gotten better. Online absentee ballot applications for our military and overseas voters is a very important service, especially now that we have our no-excuse absentee. Online voter registration, another important service for our citizens. And preparing for the elections this year, and this will be the first year of no-excuse absentee voting. So there's quite a bit of computer programming and changing and reprogramming to make sure that we're ready for that for this fall's election.
Mr. Secretary?
Yes?
How much of an increase do you think you'll see, or do you think you will, because of that non-absentee election?
So based on the experience in other states, we believe that in the first few cycles it will be relatively small. Maybe it'll go from 8-9% to 10-12%. Once people get used to this and the information is out there, normally it goes up to about 17%, and then it'll rise to about 27%. But simultaneous to that no-excuse absentee, you have townships and essentially small towns with the right to go to all vote by mail. And so, in fact, what we're seeing is a rise in the number of people voting by mail through both of those avenues, primarily through the vote by mail, but also through the no-excuse absentee. And more people going in to their county courthouse or their city clerk's office to do the in-person absentee beforehand. So if the western states are a guide for us and we do follow kind of their pattern, we will rise over time to about a third or more of our voters choosing that path, and especially be rural.
Okay.
And if the weather stays like this and the blizzards stay like this and the March elections are even sometimes having to be canceled on occasion because of this, there'll be more pressure to say we need some alternatives, especially as we age and maybe driving is less, something we want to do less.
Yes. Thank you.
We also are the bridge to our federal government's grants that are for meeting the HAVA requirements for assisting our voters with disabilities. We are normally able to hand out between $125,000 and $250,000 once every year or every 2 years to small towns, townships, cities, counties. It's often for accessibility, automatic door openers in a township hall or a ramp, sometimes just direct equipment that's needed to assist visually impaired. So those are projects that are sort of in the pipeline. When they get the money, they know they have to get it done before the August, the August election that takes place. And, for many of our smallest towns and townships, it's the way that they actually make those township halls accessible. And as we are getting older, more people with walkers, wheelchairs, et cetera, it's a tremendous service. The federal government has kind of gotten itself out of this particular granting business to a greater extent, but we were still able to get 126,000 approximately, and so 44 more projects got done. And, you know, they make a difference in people's lives. Public safety, safe at home is our primary work in public safety. It's an address confidentiality program. Some of you were around when it was created. It was created before I was elected in 2006, but in 2007, then the money was appropriated. And, you know, it's for anyone who fears people in law enforcement, people in judiciary, women who have survived domestic violence or stalking. They can have an address that is their legal address. It is a P.O. box in the region here, and that's where their mail comes, their official correspondence, all of that, and it's forwarded to their confidential where they're living. It's the main thing about it is the dramatic increase. You can see in the chart here, participants in 08, so this is at the end of the year, 111. That was sort of the first year of implementation. Went up to 400, 600, over 900, over 1,200, 1,600, and the number of households from 74 to 710. Washington State is a few years ahead of us in this process. I think they're somewhere over 25 or 2,600. And I've had people in law enforcement tell me this program has saved lives. So I think it's one of the low-cost and high-impact ways to be part of an overall security plan. There are 76 agencies that we work with that provide 104 enrollment sites, and we do a lot of education, just public education about the program. This map just shows that we were able to get coverage in almost every county. We've got to stretch out to be able to cover these last four. But it's a statewide program, and it provides this public safety service to people everywhere. So public engagement, you know, some of you know we run the paperwork part of the open enrollment or the open appointment process. Two weekends ago, we held something called Capital Code, which we got assistance from about 80, mostly younger computer specialists who helped us create some new software that makes our information more available. For example, business services, we have information on which businesses have been in good standing in our state. And so that's an important piece of information if you're tree goes down on your house in a storm and somebody pulls up in a pickup truck with a sign that says, would you like your tree cut? Would you like your roof fixed? A person who's knowledgeable can go on our website and find out, are they in good standing? They can go on the website of the Attorney General's office and find out, are there any problems? There are avenues for information that the new handheld future makes more available, and we're working to do that. We have advisory committees. Our Disabilities Advisory Committee is one of the most active, and we get regular new information and new suggestions from them, and they help us. 1 year, we identified transportation to the polls as a problem, worked with our committee to get help from Target to help fund some of those transportation services. Our election director was honored at his last national meeting about being elected the national president. I had the great pleasure of being there and to hear the comments. You know, we provide a kind of a guiding star for many states in terms of our election turnout, our election administration, and it's a lot because Gary Poser represents just the finest of public service. And we're working with the Minnesota State Bar Association, who's one of our main partners, especially the business section, the business arm, and they are partnering with us and others to develop some new corporate structures. They'll be in front of you this year. The most common one is the question of a public benefit corporation, sometimes referred to as a B corporation. The Bar Association, in conjunction with others in the community, have brought that forward, and that's part of our work. If that passes, of course, we have to redo our software and make some adjustments, but the new digitized makes that much easier than ever before. Our sources of funding, they are in the middle of changing, but over the last period of time, they've been primarily the general fund, a special kind of technology fund that comes from the surcharge on some filings. There was a temporary technology surcharge that was approved by the legislature that funded much of the building of the new system. And then the Help America Vote Act, or HAVA, which was federal dollars, which is essentially gone now. So the temporary technology surcharge came off a couple years ago. The Help America Vote funds will be used up completely. And thank you for your generosity in the last budgeting cycle of building into our overall budget the funds necessary, because those have been a very important part of funding our general elections work in particular. Thank you for this time. I know we have many other presentations, so I want to move right to questions and see if I can provide any more information for you today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary Ritchie, your business consumer services, you say new business filings. How many businesses do you keep track of that have left the state of Minnesota?
Left the state. I don't think we have any direct information about that. I'm imagining that we could, let's say once a year, do a kind of a random survey and contact businesses who filed and say, where are you in your cycle? Are you here? Are you someplace else? Or we could possibly share data with revenue, who, of course, every business has to file some form of a tax filing, and then they would be able to track if that EIN, that employer identification number, did that move to a new particular location or not. We mostly are the importers of businesses, and 60,000 is a tremendous number. We are, per capita, we create just a whole lot more businesses than most. And I think there may be an interest in some other states. In fact, Colorado got aggressive, and they were, trying to sort of get other businesses to move there. But only Delaware really is the stronger competitor to us, and they just have a kind of a marketing vision of how Delaware is going to position itself, and we struggle with that a little bit. But online, people can go anywhere.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Ritchie, do you have conversations with the Department of Revenue as far as businesses coming in? And do they check with you or vice versa? Do you let them know of the businesses so they're kind of, got an idea of what?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I've actually been, now that we've digitized, been thinking about the question of how many businesses are created who don't have to file with us because they're sole proprietors operating under their own name. And I've only found one way to approximate that number, and that would be to find a way to take the files of revenue, the names of companies and their EINs, and then run them against the newly created businesses so that those that had filed taxes but had not created a new entity in my office would fit in that category. And so I broached it on an informal basis and realized that I needed to be a lot more sophisticated in our own IT shop and then work with their IT shop and with Minute to do that. My interest was in King Banyan's estimation of the economic impact of new business creation. He thought that not knowing how many of those new individual sole proprietors were was a missing piece of information that might make his predictions more accurate. So that was kind of the main motivation for that conversation. I'm interested in all ideas about data that people would like to have, and then maybe we can find a way to do that. Some business associations have begun contacting our office to get on a monthly basis new businesses created in their neighborhoods so they can go knock on their doors, welcome them, and then say, we have a monthly barbecue or whatever, you'd be welcome to come join us. So I do think now that we're digital, maybe there'll be some other ideas, and I would welcome those.
And Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ritchie, the safe at home state coverage, is that through the county offices, and that would that be specifically through the auditor's office, or no. Is that a separate office completely?
No, they are all volunteers from the, you know, basically the organizations that are already in place. I think is it, hold it. So there are 76 social service agencies. So sometimes it's Catholic Charities, sometimes it's a shelter. And they have 104 locations where there are application assistants. So these are existing organizations. We train their staff to be an assistant. And so if, like, for example, a county attorney that's doing prosecutions of meth dealers that wants to be in the program, they use this application assistant to complete their applications, kind of a pre-screening. Those are trained volunteers from social service agencies.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Secretary Ritchie, the office then is, they tie in with another group, like you said, Catholic Charities or other people. So if we were to look for specifically office that said Safe at Home, we wouldn't find that.
Well, you would go to the website. In fact, the office called Safe at Home is in a location that I do not know, because it's a dangerous, in other states it has been physically dangerous for the staff. Sometimes a stalker or somebody who's violent has gone to the office and threatened people to get the address of the person they're finding. So I myself don't know the location of our office. Our staff is very security-minded and well-trained, and we are always on very high alert about security, because the safety of our staff is right there alongside the safety of the individuals that are in the program. There's a website. You go on Safe at Home. It's got the information there. It has the list of the social service agencies. Those social service agencies have trained application assistants. Once a year, we thank them, and we have a volunteer luncheon, and we, you know, thank them from the bottom of our hearts. But that's why the program is so cost-effective, is it's, you know, it's run in that sort of way. There's a website, there's a small office, but there's a core of volunteers sort of everywhere in the state who make the program work.
One follow-up. I should say, Secretary Ritchie, do you have stories or any anecdotes of the people's lives that have been affected by this as far as the effectiveness of the program?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, yes, we do. And, in fact, sometimes we can put a little packet together. They're extremely moving. When people talk about their ability to put their life back together and then to move on and to move forward, and how it have helped them in a sense of putting together the kids. But we also have some other stories. Like, I was with the city attorney in St. Cloud. So we're at the city and county attorney's luncheon. He had an assistant city attorney who was prosecuting meth dealers and got mobilized for Iraq. And he worried every single day for the safety of his family. And about halfway through, the county attorney realized that he could have put his family into this program and they could have been in a safe location. He's over there worrying because he's prosecuting some pretty bad characters. And so that was a trigger for us to realize we need to be more aggressive in making sure that our county attorneys, and who are really are our partners, the judges, the sheriffs, the police chiefs, county attorney, are also thinking about changing circumstances where that might make a difference. And I would, Mr. Chairman, I would be very, very honored to provide you with just, you know, a half dozen or some little handful of the stories. They are very moving. They're very dramatic in some instances.
Ms. Secretary, you get those, and we'll pass them to the committee. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Anderson was on a roll, so I couldn't keep up with him. And, if I can come back to Mr. Secretary, some of the business ideas. I know on the electronic apps, I had a little apartment that I rented out on a daily or weekly basis on a lake, and so I actually collected the sales tax. That was legal. But we sold that place, and on the application, you mark something like discontinued or whatever. But that would be a perfect place to mark moved out of state or something like that. I, you know, be an electronic option, And then that would give us a way to follow up. Maybe you have an exit interview. Why did you leave? And if we're doing that on an annual basis, then we can begin to build trends so we can measure tax policy or regulations or whatever the issues are, you know, what's helping, what's hurting. And so that's just an idea. You're already there with the electronic app.
Great idea.
Mark a box so we can get closer.
Great idea. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, thank you, Senator.
Other questions? Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome, Mr. Secretary, to the gray-haired men's committee here. I have a question about your...
Think for yourself, sir.
I've taken a little bit of heat for coming here today, so I thought I'd give a little back.
You're digging deep.
Yes. Your numbers, are they fiscal year or are they calendar year? For instance, the business registrations.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, we go January to December when we're keeping track of, you know, filings, you know, January, February, you know, that kind of thing. Our budget numbers, what we contribute to the general fund, those are on the state's fiscal year. Usually these are biennial numbers or annual numbers. So those would be sort of, you know, the middle of the year to the middle of the year. So it's been pretty consistent what we contribute to the general fund, I mean, more or less. But we track the filings because it's kind of the way in which they come to us. You know, they come to us in an annual way. We send out our renewals on an annual basis, that sort of thing.
Senator Carlson.
Other question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You have online voter registration listed here as one of your accomplishments. Can you give me a feel for how many uses it's had, how many new registrations and how many changes in registration?
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think it's been a little bit over 3/4% or changes or updates, and that's the same on same-day registration. It's always about 75% to 80%. I think there were 4,000 or something. But I can check. Mr. Chairman, Senator, I'll check and find out. You know, it's a kind of quiet period.
Very good. Other questions? Well, thanks, Mr. Secretary.
Thank you very much.
Very informative and this will probably be the last time we'll have this exact thing with you, but
I'll miss it.
Great.
Thank you.
Next, we are going to have the Department of Revenue review. Terry Steenblock and Peter Squire. How are you two?
Good, Mr. Chair, and you?
We're looking forward to hearing what you have to say. Go ahead when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Terry Steenblock, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Individual Taxes at the Department of Revenue. And with me today is our Chief Financial Officer, Peter Squira. Today, you should be getting a handout that looks something like this. We're going to walk you through just kind of an overview of the agency and follow up on some of the things that we discussed last legislative session. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Squira, who's going to start.
Mr. Chairman, members, hello. My name is Peter Squira, Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Revenue.
And we talked about your other life, Peter.
My other life was at the Department of Natural Resources just under a year ago, and it's nice to see this committee. So, reminding me of my former life. Before you is a handout that may look familiar to all of you. It's the same handout that we passed out last year during the biennial budget discussions. On it is our mission. Our mission has not changed since last discussion period. We are still in the business of gaining compliance with tax laws to finance the programs of the state of Minnesota. And we do that through our strategies, our four strategies, and our four values. The budget that was approved last year and our spending plan for fiscal year 14 includes $148 million. That includes the largest portion of that is our salary dollars, $140 million, 95% of that is from the general fund. We also have small portions of other funding mechanisms that we collect the tax for the environmental cluster and gas clusters as well. It also includes our fee-for-service dollars for local option sales tax and other departments that request our services. Last year's fiscal year 13's full-time equivalent number averaged 1,520 FTEs. And with those dollars, we serve 3.8 million individual income taxpayers, 204 corporations, 204,000 corporations, 680,000 property tax refund claimants, 284 businesses that collect sales tax. These numbers don't change, are not real volatile from year to year. So we've updated these numbers, but they'll look a lot like what you saw last year at this time. We also process some highlights here, 10.8 million returns and payments in any given year. We answer 678,000 phone calls with questions on tax and tax-related issues, and we audit 120,000 returns. On the bottom of the sheet, we focus our energies. We've recently focused our energies on voluntary compliance, and the taxes we collect are about 96, 97% voluntary compliance. So these are taxpayers who file and pay their taxes voluntarily.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
Members, we're going to flip to the other side, okay. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the second page of the document.
Great.
I want to highlight a little bit the unsession efforts that are happening at the Department of Revenue. As you know, the governor has an unsession effort that is focused on making government better, faster, simpler, and more efficient for people. Within the Department of Revenue, we have a couple different focuses that we're working on in relation to the unsession. We are currently reviewing statutes and looking at ways that we can reduce the statutes and simplify those as well. We are also looking at the number of forms and payment vouchers that taxpayers are required to touch in order to conduct business with us and look for ways to simplify or eliminate those as well as part of the unsession effort. The other thing I wanted to touch on, as you may recall, last year we were scheduled to implement the debit card with this filing season. Last summer, we had made a decision to postpone the implementation of the debit cards to make sure that we were implementing a quality product and one that was focused on the privacy and the security of taxpayers. We are continuing to postpone that, and one of the reasons why, as we were out and about last year, the other thing that we became aware of, a lot of taxpayers were asking us if they could have their refund direct deposited into their account. And so we discovered that we had some work that needed to be done in the areas of educating people on the ability to be able to direct deposit their refund. So as you can see on the handout, we do have a campaign that we're focused on that is focused on making sure that taxpayers know that they do have the ability to direct deposit their refunds. We've done some very targeted outreach this year, sent letters to all the tax preparers, letting them know that direct deposit is an option. We've outreached to the software vendors as well to make sure that they're offering the ability to direct deposit within their software products. So our focus this year is to increase the number of direct deposit users. Also want to touch on some outreach efforts. We have really been focused on making sure that people have the tools and the resources they need to understand the tax system and comply with the rules that they need to. And so this year we've done quite a bit of outreach. We have held 110 outreach activities at touching 7,500 taxpayers in the area of minority and low-income communities, letting them know that there's tax credits available and that there's resources available to help them get their returns filed. We've also partnered with our friends at Veterans Affairs and attended 7 reintegration programs with the military folks, and that's helping them understand what tax programs are available to them as members of the military. We've held 7 classes to help employers understand the business tax obligations in the area of withholding, and we have partnered with DEED and the IRS with those classes as well and touched more than 400 business owners in that area. We've also held 125 sales and use tax training sessions this year and contacted or come in contact with more than 5,000 taxpayers, educating them on the sales and use tax laws and their requirements as taxpayers. This year, we did have some law changes, and we implemented a new process to communicate those law changes. We held 10 conference calls with tax professionals, businesses, and members of the media. We did those on a scheduled day of the week, made sure we had a dedicated website for those law changes, and then also took time to answer taxpayers' questions after delivering what the law changes were. We have also done over 200 community outreach events focused on the tax reform and the property taxes and local government aid, and we've connected with more than 10,000 taxpayers in that area. So we've done quite a bit of effort and work on our outreach activities, and we will continue to do that. And then lastly, I want to talk a little bit about some of the things that we were here last year and talked with you about. So last year we talked about this year we would be implementing version 9 of our integrated tax system. So we did do a significant upgrade to that system, implementing the latest version, which allows us to more easily access information and make sure that we're processing returns and adding functionality that's more user-friendly to the taxpayers. The agency has been focused significantly on lean activities, looking for ways to make the agency better and more effective. And this year, we were the winners of the Governor's Continuous Improvement Award. We did do a project that was related to the outgoing mailing within the agency. We mail quite a bit of mail, and so looking at how we could streamline that and make that more efficient with a savings of over $500,000 a year. The next item that I want to touch on was a piece of legislation that was granted to us, and this was the property tax grant funding. We did receive funding to implement $300,000 grants with the counties. The application process for that closed in December, and we will be issuing grants to the counties in the very near future, and that was to help with the implementation of a new computer system. The second piece there is the VitaSite grant funding. Last year, you provided funding to our VITA program, and the VITA is the Voluntary Income Tax Assistance Program, where we're providing assistance to low-income senior citizens and minority individuals to be able to file their tax returns to us. You did grant an additional $200,000, making $400,000 available. The application process for that has closed, and the grants were issued in October, and we'll be able to provide more of an update in September when we get our regular reports from the grant recipients. But the grants are issued in areas that help, again, more taxpayers be able to file their returns with us. The wage levy payment and disclosure legislation was passed, requiring that wage levy payments and disclosures be electronically submitted to us. And just as a reference, the wage levy payments and disclosures, if you have a taxpayer who has not responded to any efforts from the agency and they owe us money, we send the employer a wage levy asking them to garnish the wages. So this legislation allows the electronic submission of the wage levy payment and disclosures that has been put into place. We have allowed the business community to have kind of a trial period to in the event that they want to program their systems or just become familiar with entering those one at a time. So we will have the effective date of that be March 1st. But it is completed and it is in production. And then last year when we were here, we talked to you a little bit about something that we were implementing. We were going to be implementing a free electronic homeowner refund tool. We did implement that. It was released on March 26th of last year, and we've had 88,000 taxpayers use the free tool to be able to file their homeowner's refund. And then lastly, when we were here last year, we talked to you about some enhancements that we would be making to our e-services system. And the e-services system is the system that allows business taxpayers to file and pay their returns. It also allows them to see copies of their returns or communicate with the agency. We did make some enhancements to that, and those were implemented on March 26th as well, and we've gotten very good feedback on those implementations and enhancements, and we're continuing to look at more ways we can enhance the system and additional functionality we can put in there as well. And with that, we will stand for any questions you may have.
Sharon Gazalka.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. A couple brief comments, and then I got some questions. The first one was what I talked to Secretary Ritchie about. The form was actually that I did was to the Minnesota Revenue. When you're changing your sales tax or discontinuing it, you mark a box there, and that would be great if we began to measure if people were leaving. We could follow up, you know, why are you leaving, just so we have a sense of where people are going. And I don't know if that would be shared with Secretary of State's office or not, but it's a simple tool that we could take advantage of to try to figure out what people are doing. And I had to smile. It says, we serve 3.8 million individual income taxpayers. I'm not sure most of them would think you were serving them, but thank you for what you do. But I know, you know, it's always a tough part. The question I wanted to ask about is, you know, last year we had basically four business tax increases, the sales tax, the business property tax, reducing corporate reductions, and income tax bracket increases. So I think there's going to be a sensitivity among a lot of business people, just all the things going on. And that leads me finally to my question is, I've heard from a few industries, that business industries, that when they were getting audited, they felt like the people auditing them just didn't understand business and appropriate deductions. And one example in particular was they had a profit-sharing plan for their employees, and so that was clearly a deduction, but they had to fight for it. It was like they should just know this. This is a common deductible expense. You know, and so that's my question is, how much experience do your tax auditors have related to business? Because that's a pretty important thing for Minnesota, that we're trying to work with the community, business community, and not, I know you're the ones that hold them responsible, but, you know, not wasting the opportunity to try to help them walk through stuff.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Steenblatt.
That's a great question. This year we have really focused on our business training. Our sales, and we've heard feedback from you and members of the community, and our sales tax division has worked very hard at revamping their entire training program for auditors, and that includes both new hire and existing auditors. So we've done quite a bit of work in that area, and we will continue to do that. If there's specific questions from particular businesses that we can follow up with auditors, we would certainly do that. But we have, as part of our outreach efforts this year, revamped all of our training material and made some enhancements to that training program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that. And I, maybe I'll try to have some dialogue, because some people are just flat out afraid because they don't know where that's going to lead. But, with that, so I'll try to keep in contact with you. And again, thank you for what you do. That's a difficult position you're in.
Thank you. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Steinbach or Mr. Squira, it says here your outreach efforts, you've outreached to 7,500 taxpayers. You've had integration groups with soldiers and families. You've had sales and use tax training sessions and 200 community outreach events. You've trying to be more friendly user with your technology and stuff. What are your exit interviews as far as, and I think I'm piggybacking on Senator Gazalka's, how well are you liked? I mean, do you do an exit interview or an exit survey, or do you do any kind of survey with these people to find out what their feelings are about? Because I've got the same situation in my district where you've audited businesses, and they're not very appreciative of what you do to them. So I'm just wondering what kind of feedback you get, or do you do anything?
Ms. Steenblatt.
Mr. Chair, Senator, there's a few things that we do. One of the things that we do before we start any audit, the taxpayer receives a letter from us letting them know that we will be conducting an audit. And as part of that process, we put the supervisor's name and telephone number on the letter, so that if there are concerns or any feedback, they have somebody that they can reach out to even before the audit process starts, and we encourage them to do that. We also have some things in place where We will, upon an audit closing, we will send a survey to the taxpayer to get their feedback. We also periodically will call taxpayers to get their feedback. So we do have some things that are in place. We are also working on a formalized feedback program.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, do you have some examples of your survey feedback that we could see what people have commented from soldiers, from individual taxpayers, from businesses, from these specifically outreach groups that you've from what you tell us you've had contact with? Do you have any examples of those that we could see?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't have those examples with me right now, but we could certainly provide
feedback.
Ms. Dean Block, if you could get those to Senator Anderson, that'd be great. Senator Deems.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Dean Block, on your leaflet here, you show that you're auditing about 120,000 returns a year. Is that number pretty static each year, or is that number varying?
Ms. Dean Block.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that number remains relatively the same as far as the number of audits. You know, there's variables that come into play as far as the number of audits that are conducted, but it's relatively about the same, as Mr. Squirrel mentioned. All these numbers are relatively about the same from year to year.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Deems.
Senator
Deems.
Give me just a brief outline of what different things you're using to determining who and how they'll be audited.
Ms. Dean Block.
Or your premises of auditing somebody?
You know, the audit criteria is confidential, and we can't disclose the audit criteria, and that's in statute as well. So I can't share with you the details of what is taken into consideration when we do the audits. But all tax types have auditing in place, so regardless of the tax type, there are audit processes in place.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Deems.
Maybe I misunderstood, or maybe I'm not making my question clear. I understand you can't share with me once you determine you're going to audit XYZ, you can't make that public as far as what you're auditing for. But are you saying that you can't even share with us the criteria you use? I mean, is it a random? You can't share any of that with us?
No, the audit criteria is all confidential. Mr. Chair, sorry.
Scary with itself. Thank you, ma'am.
Other questions? For you, Ms. Steenblock, I'm interested in that property tax, the prison, program that we instituted last year, and you say you've dealt with 85 counties. And you think that's been pretty successful?
Mr. Chair, members, the $300,000 grants that you provided the Department of Revenue for grants to counties, that's going to help the counties on their end of implementing the system itself. The Department of Revenue is also working on the PRISM system. And so the portion that we're talking about here is the grants. 85 counties have applied. Each county will get a share of the $300,000. And so we're implementing the grant program that was provided us last year in hopes that the PRISM program will be funded at the county level.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you both.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very informative. Thanks a lot. Next, we have the Legislative Coordinating Commission review. Greg Hubinger, Executive Director of LCC, welcome. And proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission. My update is going to be significantly briefer than those that preceded me. I'll be focusing entirely on the budget that was adopted for the current biennium. You'll recall that in the 13th session, That you increase the appropriations for the joint legislative offices and commissions by about $1.2 million per year, which represented an 8.4% increase. That compares to an increase for the Senate of about 9.2% and for the House of 9.5%, according to my calculations anyway. I wanted to thank you for hearing our request last session and for increasing the appropriations for the joint offices that enable us to support the work of the Senate and the House. Following the pattern of recent biennia, the legislature appropriated a single dollar amount to the LCC, which was then required to allocate those funds to the other joint agencies and legislative commissions. The LCC leadership was very committed to dealing with one specific issue, which was to restore the staffing levels of the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Due to staff turnover and declining budgets over the last several years, their staffing levels had reduced, which was making it difficult for them to carry out their work. So a third of the new funding, of the increased funding for the joint offices, was dedicated to that office for restoring staffing levels. The remaining new funds were largely used to support the salary plan, which enabled legislative staff to receive their first salary increases in about 5 years. The salary plan that was used by the LCC mirrored that of the Senate and the House. I think you have in your packets a one-page handout that we provided that shows the appropriations to the joint offices. The top half is roughly the general fund appropriations to our offices, shows each of the offices and their appropriations for each year. The bottom half reflects the non-general fund appropriations that support the work of LCCMR, the Lasard Sams Council, the Energy Commission, and some miscellaneous appropriations to the LCC. Mr. Chair, that's a quick rundown of our appropriations. I'd be glad to help answer any questions that you might have.
Well, Mr. Eubinger, just to refresh our memory, maybe even give us a little, and I appreciate the fact that you keep it brief, but maybe just kind of outline what you consider to be three, four, or five of your more significant jobs other than funding the Office of the Legislative Auditor.
Mr. Chair and members, I would be more comfortable talking about the work of the LCC itself.
That'd be great. That's what I kind of meant. Yeah, I'm sorry.
I'm not in a good position to talk about what the revised statutes have done or the director of the library is
doing. And I was just in jest anyway. Just tell us what the LCC does.
A significant portion of our work last session was supporting various commissions and task forces that had been established either over time or recently. Some of you may know that we staff the Subcommittee on Employee Relations that reviews and provides interim approval of state labor contracts. We also support the meetings for the Sports Facilities Commission, the MNSURE Oversight Commission, the Permanent School Funds Trust Commission, the Electronic Roster Task Force. And so for all of those meetings, we help provide the administrative support that enables those groups to do their work. We also had a number of search committees that met last year to fund vacancies for the director of the library, for the director of the Office of the Economic Status of Women, and for the Legislative Energy Commission. So those are some of the kind of tasks that we were involved with during this last interim.
Very good. Any questions, Senator Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hubinger, you just briefly, in running through all those last different areas that you're being asked to be part of, you mentioned the MNSURE oversight. What part did you play in that? Or where how does that fit into your overall requirements?
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, we just provide the framework for those meetings. Establishing the website for each of those groups, setting up the listserv so that members of the public can be notified about those meetings so that they can attend, helping get the agenda set, helping making meeting arrangements, and then processing members' per diems and expenses.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Anderson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Mr. Hubinger, how many meetings, you said setting up meetings for MNSURE, how many meetings do you call setting up for the MNSURE oversight I guess, team or group or whatever you want to call it.
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, I believe that they met roughly monthly during the interim.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you. And Mr. Hubinger, as they got closer to the deadline that was required in state law, I believe that was October 1st, did they meet more often than just monthly?
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, I believe that there were a number of meetings that happened around that deadline.
So roughly, could you give us an idea how many, other than just the monthly?
Senator Anderson, Mr. Hubinger.
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, I believe that there were three or four meetings that occurred perhaps 2 or 3 weeks apart.
Other questions? I probably have a question for Mr. Nobles. Mr. Hubinger, that's great. We appreciate the work that you do, and thanks for the report.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Nobles, I think you do great work, and I was just wondering Mr. Hubinger mentioned that a third of the increase is because we didn't think you were funded well enough, and for the work that you do. Just give us a little help in what's happened in the interim. How's that?
Mr. Chairman and members, for the record, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor. And first, I want to start by thanking you, Mr. Chairman, and others who helped facilitate the funding that we did receive. It was very helpful. The purpose, as Mr. Hubinger said, was to help the Office of the Legislative Auditor stabilize our staffing at 60 positions. I do remind you because of previous budget cuts, we did lose 20 positions, so we used to be an organization of 80. But since that occurred, it has been my goal not necessarily to restore those 20 lost positions, but to simply stabilize our staffing at 60. I would also note that during that same period of time, when we've been trying to stabilize our staffing at 60, we have had a significant amount of turnover, and we also have had additional responsibilities given to us. During that period of time, the legacy amendment was enacted, approved by the voters, and that comes under our jurisdiction. So that was a significant amount of money added to our audit responsibilities. And also, mention was just made of Minsure. Minsure, enacted by the legislature, is also under the jurisdiction and audit responsibility of the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Mr. Chairman, I would characterize the challenges that we face, have in the past, and I think we'll continue to face, even with the additional funding that we've received, in two ways. We have a horizontal challenge and we have a vertical challenge. The horizontal challenge is that our responsibility to audit is enormous. We are the auditor of state government. We're responsible for auditing the state's annual financial statements. We are responsible for auditing the state's use of federal funds, and that's also an annual audit that is required. We also have jurisdiction and responsibility to audit everything in the executive branch, from the governor's office down to the Board of Cosmetology. We also have jurisdiction and responsibility to audit everything in the judicial branch. These are our responsibilities and mission as a part of extending legislative oversight and accountability throughout state government. We also have responsibility to audit the state's use of money when it grants money to nonprofit organizations, and that's many hundreds of millions of dollars a year. We also are the auditor of the Metropolitan Airports Commission, the Metropolitan Mosquito Control District, and the Metropolitan Sports Facilities Authority. So it is a vast array of responsibilities. I might mention it also includes the University of Minnesota, MNSCU, and many other organizations. But with that sort of very vast amount of responsibility, we cannot audit everything on any frequent basis. So I decided long ago that the way to manage this office is with a strategic approach, and that is to select those organizations that are at highest risk of some difficulty. And we do have to fulfill certain mandates under federal law and state law. But once we get to making decisions, we make those decisions based certainly on what are the concerns and interests of legislators And for example, I would note that I know that there is a very high level of interest and concern and accountability for the legacy funds, and so we do make that a high priority. There is also a great deal of concern about MNsure and how the money was used, and so we are making that a very high priority this year, and we are currently in the process of conducting a fairly comprehensive audit of the way federal funds were used to establish MNsure. But we also have to make decisions about what not to audit. And so over the years, we have decided, for various reasons, to focus our resources on the critical functions and organizations of state government. That means I decided that we would no longer go to the University of Minnesota. They have a fairly strong internal audit office there. We still have jurisdiction to go there on an as-needed ad hoc basis. But again, stretching our resources means that we have not for a long period of time, and I don't anticipate in the future, doing financial audit work at the University of Minnesota. We have also significantly reduced our audit presence at the Minnesota State Colleges and University System. They, again, get a certain amount of outside audit work. They have a strong internal audit organization, which, frankly, is staffed completely by former members of my staff. Which is true, frankly, around state government generally. I've also decided that we will no longer audit at the Metropolitan Airports Commission. Again, they have a strong internal audit office there, completely staffed by former OLA auditors. So I have confidence that that accountability is being considered and taken into account there. But again, we do retain the legal authority to go there on an ad hoc basis. We also dropped our audit presence at the Metropolitan Mosquito Control District and at the State Fair. That's, again, just an indication of how we're trying to manage our resources. We can't go everywhere. I mentioned that we have two challenges, and I think I've covered the one that is the horizontal challenge. But once we make a choice to where we're going to go, whether it's at the Department of Human Services, the Department of Commerce, or wherever else we go, MNsure, for example. I think it is your expectation when you created this office that we are supposed to go deep, and that's the vertical challenge. And so we need a team of auditors that can dig deep into the details of the data and documents that exist throughout state government. And I would remind you that you gave us very significant authority to look at all documents and all data, regardless of classification. And that is the way we can extend legislative oversight and accountability beyond what you can do, frankly, in these committee hearings. Because, frankly, I send audit teams out who simply take up residence in Department of Human Services or at the Department of Commerce or at MNsure, and they ask to see all the documents, all the data, all the emails, anything and everything we need to see, private data, confidential data, anything and everything. You've also given us subpoena power, which we use from time to time, to again dig deep into these organizations. But that does require us to have a team of auditors who are well qualified and well trained and experienced. And again, that takes me back to thank you again for helping us stabilize our staffing, because we were having a significant challenge with turnover. And we would have staff trained and experienced for 2 or 3 years, and then they would leave. And I'm hoping that the additional funding that you've provided will at least give us some opportunity for salary adjustments that will give staff some incentive to stay with us a little longer than they have in the past. Mr. Chairman, I just want to note one final thing. And that is, I have not come to you or the committee in the House with jurisdiction over our budget and ever ask for a supplementary or additional funding. We have we received the additional funding that was referenced at the initiative of you, Mr. Chairman, and others, and we appreciate that. My approach has been to say at the end of the legislative session, I will manage the office with the resources we received. There are some members of the Legislative Audit Commission that feel that that's been a mistake, frankly, on my part, and that it has led to the diminishment of the funding and staffing. And so there are some members who feel like I should be taking this opportunity during this legislative session, since it appears that there is a healthy balance in the state treasury, to ask you for more money. I personally am not going to do that, but there are some members who may, on the House side, work towards that objective. So I give you that so you are not blindsided by that. They will make that request because they would like the Office of the Legislative Auditor to do more IT security audits. They would like us to do more evaluations, and they would like us to have a legal counsel in-house. That would be the purpose of that request. But that is, Mr. Chairman, an initiative that is coming from some members of the Legislative Audit Commission. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your time. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Is there questions? Senator Chamberlain.
I'll be brief.
You don't have to be brief. You haven't even spoken yet. So
I'm saving it. Mr. Chair, Mr. Nobles, I will be brief. Thank you.
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Nobles, you mentioned the turnover. What is the pay scale in your office compared with the pay scale that an auditor would see in the outside? And is that one of the problems you're having, is a lack of comparison?
Mr.
Chairman, Senator Carlson, it is a challenge. We live in a very vibrant metropolitan area with many opportunities for CPAs and other people trained in the kind of training and certifications that my staff have. I have staff that are not only certified CPAs, but they're also certified as internal auditors. They're certified to audit IT security systems. So they're very attractive to banks, to insurance companies, to Target. We've lost a lot of staff to Target and other corporations in the Twin Cities. We will never, Senator, be able to match the salaries that are offered in the private sector. We start people at about $43,000, $44,000 out of school. We try to advance them. As you know, for a period of time, not that long ago, there were salary freezes. And so we're digging our way out of that. But frankly, we will not be able to match the private sector. But what we can offer, and I offer this very vigorously to the staff that work in my office, and that is an opportunity to work in a very challenging environment where what you do will really matter. You know, they go to their friends and neighbors and relatives and are able to talk about what they do. And what they do matters to every citizen in this state, and that is try and make state government work better and assure that there is accountability. That's why when there are issues that pop up where citizens have questions about what's going on in state government, they can say to their neighbors, their friends, their relatives, why don't you give the legislative auditor a call? Our phone is pretty much ringing every day with people who have issues, whether they're public officials, citizens, or whomever, addressing to us concerns about Minsure, about DNR, about anything and everything that goes on in state government. And we try to be responsive to that. And that gives, I think, staff a real sense of satisfaction and that they know that they can do work that ultimately will matter and make a difference. So every month I give a speech at our OLA staff meeting about the glory of working at the Office of the Legislative Auditor and hope that that compensates some.
Good. Thanks.
Thank you.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you. Mr. Nobles, thank you for all the work that you do. I appreciate your ability to encourage and challenge and go forward. As mentioned before, Mr. Hubinger was up, and he said something about oversight of Minsure and the website, and then you mentioned how federal funds were used to help establish your overseeing that. How much involvement is the LCC or your office in relationship to the website establishment or those funds that were used? How much involvement were you involved with that whole thing?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, we were not involved in the development itself. But from the establishment in state law of Minsure, we knew we were going to be the auditor of Minsure, and we are. We are also required under federal law, a law referred to often as the Single Audit Act, We are required to audit all of the money that the state receives, major funds that the state receives from the federal government, and obviously MNsure was a very large investment of federal money. And so, as I mentioned, we are currently conducting an audit at MNsure. I have a team of auditors there as we speak, examining how that federal money was used. We have a wide range of questions and issues we're addressing, the contracts, the relationship between the state and the performance of the contractors, the state's management of those contracts, and many other issues as well. So, you know, again, our involvement comes somewhat after the fact from the development, but we will be there, and I'm hopeful of giving you a fairly comprehensive report on how that money was used within a few months.
Sarah Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nobles, do you know what the ratio was as far as state funds to federal funds in establishing that website?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, almost all of the money for the establishment of the website itself came from the federal government. But there was some participation by the state because in addition to establishing the MNsure website, the state decided to redesign its eligibility determination software for Medicaid and Minnesota Care. And that system, which is being redesigned and will and is now plugged in to MNsure, the state's participation in that was a ratio of 10% of the state money to 90% federal money. All the rest of the money was a federal grant.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? No, thank you very much, Mr. Nobles. Mr. Hubinger, thank you very much. It was a good report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Ms. Parnell, minute. I almost feel like I had to slow that down a little bit and say minute. Welcome to our humble abode. It's not as hot as 112, you know. It's a lot cooler over here.
Good afternoon.
Go ahead. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Carolyn Parnell. I'm the chief. Oh, sorry. Can you hear me?
Well,
I'm the
chief
information officer for the state of Minnesota and the commissioner of Minnesota IT, which we shortened to MNIT. So I'm happy to be here to give you an update on our agency and our responsibilities. We are the technology agency for the state of Minnesota in the executive branch. We do provide the full spectrum of IT services for all of the executive branch boards and agencies. There's more than 80 of them in number. And we also provide services to other entities in local government and higher education. So, for example, we provide email services to the City of St. Paul, and we provide network connectivity to all of the MNSCU institutions across the state. So we really are responsible for leadership and direction in relationship to the IT that executive branch agencies need to conduct their business. We're responsible for standards and oversight, application life cycles, systems operations. We keep everything running, as well as security management. So we do a lot. We have a lot of connectivity all over the state. We don't actually own those networks, but we have a lot of contracts with a lot of telcos around the state who provide connectivity in a variety of places and a variety of technologies. We provide systems anywhere from collecting taxes to tracking road technology to tools like enterprise email that keeps our workforce productive, and a lot of storage technology with the vast volume of data that the state of Minnesota collects. We are approximately 2,055 employees. That number hovers between 2,000 and 2,100 on a sort of ongoing basis. We have 22 agency-based offices, 90 physical locations around the state. We manage 2,000-plus distinct applications, anything from a case management system to a relatively small board to the unemployment insurance system that you all know transacts an awful lot of business for deed, the Gentax system that collects taxes for the state of Minnesota. All of those agencies have technology as a base for many of their transactions and their services, and we support all of those systems. We have a combined annual operating budget of about $450 million. Some services are provided at an enterprise level. So, for example, we have enterprise email where all agencies take advantage of the centralized email that we provide. And there are others that are delivered by the locally based minute office. The way we're organized is that we have a central minute organization, but we also have what we call minute at agencies. So the IT staff that provides support, for example, to the Department of Corrections is referred to as minute at corrections. It's the way that we can ensure that those unique needs that agencies have are met by the people who know them best. So we can't expect IT employees to have such a broad sense of specialization that they could meet any need that any agency has. So housing prisoners is very different from building roads, is very different from collecting tax, et cetera. When we first pulled together all of the IT within the state executive branch, we found that there were all kinds of definitions of IT. So one agency might call a help desk a help desk. Another agency might call a service desk. One of the first things we had to do was come up with a nomenclature that fit everybody and every agency. We did that through an IT reference model. So we have a basic set of services that everybody understands with one language. And given that IT reference model, we were able to develop service-level agreements with every single agency. So every agency now has a measure of what IT they use, how it's provided, who provides it, and how much it costs. We do not get central funding to provide IT. Every single agency determines how much IT they need, and we deliver it to them through service-level agreements. So they determine what IT budgets they are going to put into their annual budgets, what portion of that is IT. And then we have a chargeback mechanism and rates that calculate what those services are worth. Those service level agreements have been in place since the summer of 2012, I believe the beginning of fiscal year 13. And when you put all of them together for all the agencies, because each agency has an individualized service level agreement, it comes to about 9,000 pages. It was a big job. So we do manage a $450 million annual budget, but only about $5 million of that comes directly to Minute from the general fund. And that's largely to meet security needs. We have now organized all procurement so that all IT procurement is managed through Minute Services. It has been a great way to leverage volume discounts, and we have saved a significant amount of money by leveraging those volumes. Just a little reminder that in 2011, you all handed us the responsibility of IT consolidation, taking these 80-plus different ways of doing IT, and asked us to pull it all together and to be accountable for all of IT that occurred in the state. I will remind you that we did not get any money for this effort. It's something we are doing basically in our spare time. We are not in the business of IT consolidation. We're in the business of meeting the needs of agencies by providing them IT. But we have, we believe, made a great deal of progress in terms of IT consolidation. Fortunately, we did not have a lot of expectations around IT consolidation, but I have promised the legislature and the governor a good deal of efficiency in how IT is delivered. So people have asked me, well, what's the value of IT consolidation? And there's a number of ways to look at it. So, for example, now we do have a holistic view of IT across all agencies. No one had ever really done an inventory of IT in the executive branch. There was no coordinated effort just in terms of what technology tools to use. So there was a lot of duplication, a lot of redundancy. We now have that holistic view of IT in the executive branch. We've been able to define metrics. So the service level agreements that we have with every agency define the expectations that they have around service levels, for example, and how quickly a help desk might respond to a problem that they're having. We have, for the first time, a complete portfolio of application or an inventory of applications, and there are a lot of them. And I am accountable for IT in the executive branch. Financially, we now have a single IT budget. We don't have to go scurrying and gathering a lot of information to find out what the state is spending on IT. We have, as I mentioned before, an enterprise approach to sourcing and are able to negotiate with vendors to the state's advantage. We've done this without incurring a good deal of cost for the state of Minnesota. There are many states that are in one phase of consolidation or another. Many of them have received money for it and just pulled someone in from the outside to tell them how to do IT consolidation. We didn't have that luxury, but in my mind, it's really been a benefit. Because we've been able to be very careful, we've been able to be very inclusive in how we make this transformation of how IT is delivered in the state. Technically, we are well on our way to shifting the workload from the agencies of those IT services that are better delivered from a consolidated state. And I'll use email as an example again. So there was a time when one agency might have 28 different email servers, and another agency might have 15 email servers. They didn't have the same email address syntax. They did not have, the governor did not have a way to send an email to all employees, for example. We've been able to roll that up, deliver that much more efficiently and cheaper from an enterprise perspective and consolidated state through IT consolidation. Another big advantage is that we have a bench of IT skill set that we can draw from. We know who is skilled in what particular aspect of IT, and as you know, there's a lot of specialization within IT, especially in a state that has such a variety of IT solutions. We are now able to reach across those agency boundaries and put people with the skill sets that we need in the places that we need them much more quickly and efficiently than we have been able to in the past. I won't go through this. This is just a picture of how we're organizing to deliver those consolidated IT services. We are building what we call the Minute Cloud, and it is going to be the source of those consolidated services that are going to be the same for every single agency, and then that will preserve the ability to be able to meet the really unique needs of agencies beyond those basic services. This is another very busy slide, but this is just an example of the approach that we're taking to the technical aspect of consolidation. So these are, I think there's 18 projects in our tactical plan that's building the cloud. This is the set of services that we're moving out of agencies in order to deliver them centrally. We're making great progress in them. The first one that we tackled was the data center. We were required to move our data center out of the Centennial Office Building in a very truncated period of time due to the capital restoration project. They needed that space for offices. So we have moved a good deal of the very mission-critical systems out of that data center and into a much more robust state-of-the-art data center in Woodbury. That is to everybody's benefit. We can have a higher level of security and a much better environment for those systems. We'll continue to do that. I think the state has about 40 different data centers. The vast majority of them substandard in terms of both security and environment, and we're well on our way to moving them to our state-of-the-art data centers. The other requirement for IT consolidation was that of this particular fiscal year 14, we started being responsible for all IT projects. So we have a program portfolio. We have hired Jesse Ullman, who is here with me today, as our assistant commissioner for projects and initiatives, all of those projects that have an IT component, particularly those that have been funded by the legislature. We have what we now call a state project management office for the first time. We have common project management tools and methodology, risk assessment oversight. We have regular and frequent reporting on major projects. And we have, for the first time, a sharing of project management resources across agencies. So we have a very centralized approach to managing and delivering these big IT projects. In this particular biennium, we have these projects that have been funded by the legislature. Those that are in greens are the ones that this particular committee approved of. And for the first time in this fiscal year, that those information technology project dollars are transferred to MNIT. We manage those dollars, and we deliver the project with those dollars. We are in the process of a very robust and rigorous accountability for what those projects consist of, what IT's responsibility is versus the responsibility of the agency. We have regular reporting requirements, definition requirements, and an ongoing risk assessment of each one of them. For those of you who are interested in what we might have proposed for the governor's idea for an unsession, you know, our legislation is not that old. A good deal of it was written in the 2011 session. We do not have decades of language that has sort of built on top of each other. In addition, we did a good deal of cleanup in the last legislative session. So we just have a few minor deletions of language that is repetitive from one part of the statute to the other. But I do want to point out that we, in addition to doing IT consolidation, are trying to be leaders in the innovation in state government and in this particular local area. I think that it's the only way we're going to increase our level of service to citizens through the use of technology. So when the governor went out to the public to gather ideas for the unsession, we provided the online tool that he used in order to gather those ideas and rate them and start a conversation around them. And the last thing, we are also taking part in the governor's plain language initiative and focusing on state agency websites. Other than that, we do not have a lot of contributions, I would say, to the end session, but we are very much interested in that initiative. So with that, any questions?
Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Pardell, first of all, thank you for your work. I was part of this committee in 2011 when we worked through the process of doing this, and you know, we felt there would be duplication and redundancy that could be addressed. And so my first question, I'm just wondering, you said you absorbed extraordinary costs of consolidation without raising total IT costs. Was that because of some of the savings you realized, all multiple emails, redundancy, et cetera?
I would not say that we have captured a good deal of savings. You know, savings is one thing, cost avoidance is another. The effect, I think, is the same. We have not captured a lot of dollars. The legislation allowed us to capture some savings from the last fiscal year, but I think mostly we have done a lot of this work in-house. My executive team has been very, very busy in getting these things accomplished, and we've also tapped employees. So instead, again, of pulling in outside consultants to design the new data center, we knew that we had a fair amount of very skilled IT employees. So we pulled them in, asked them to redesign how we deliver data center services. So it's not been a process of collecting money through savings. It's mostly been how we deliver things and doing a lot of the work ourselves.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair. One follow-up, too. I heard you talk about new innovations and increased level of service. Are you, because I can see down the road through efficiencies that there would have been a potential cost savings. So are you, is your plan then to use that for new innovation and new service, or will your budget be lower in the future?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members, you know, again, we do not set the IT budget, and in fact, if you look at the last fiscal year, the IT budget actually went up because of the investment in new IT systems. We have enough legacy systems out there that need is going to exist for a while, but we do expect to find actual savings, and we expect to plow that into reinvestment in technology that will allow for even more savings down the road.
And thank you for your service.
Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you clearly do a lot of things, and you do a lot of things very well, so thank you. And so I'm compelled to ask, were you involved at all with this last email issue with our group-wise system? I just have to preface the remark because there's no place on the planet in 2014, especially the United States, where a major industry would be without email for 5 days. So is that not going to happen? If you're involved in that, if you're not, tell me, and that's fine. But if you are, just a two-minute overview, what happened, and will that not happen again to any agency in our state department, in our state? I mean, 5 days is really kind of nuts. But you do a lot well. I don't want to take all this and, you know, trash it. You do a lot very well. But I'm just curious, can we not let that happen again?
Mr. Chair, members, we do not provide email services to the Senate. We stand ready.
Please, can we hire?
If we're asked.
Willing. Yeah, we're willing.
We are actually very, very pleased with our enterprise delivery email that we have partnered with Microsoft on. But no, we had no part in that.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. And Senator Chamberlain, I think we probably will, though, have a hearing concerning the Senate, and because we did a lot of work in the off-season putting things together, and it's always darkest before the dawn, we're going to hope. Senator Anderson.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Parnell, for your presentation, and thank you for all you've done, and you've got some bright things ahead of you and a lot of work to do. But just to ask you, you've got here in your presentation the IT project portfolio, and you show in green three, four areas that are new because of the 2013 funding that you received. The other areas that you show in black here that are bullet points, are there timelines for each one as to, you know, when you started, when you're projected to be completed? And one that I'm looking at is the system modernization. I think that's for either, is that the Department of Health and Human Services or
Department
just
the
Human
Services? Department of Human Services, yeah.
Okay. If you could give me a timeline on some of those things, that'd be great.
I didn't bring my monthly project portfolio report with me, but every single one of these has a pretty robust schedule. Now, we don't necessarily set that schedule. We work with the agency. So for the systems modernization, they have just started that process, and they're just starting the actual design of that process. It's something that will occur over several years. Some of these other projects, the state crime reporting system replacement, also has its own timeline based on both the resources that IT brings to the project, but also the resources that the agency brings to the project. So everyone works independently, has its own schedule, is tracked by its own schedule, and I'm happy to share any of that information with you if you're interested. I can say that I believe for the first time we do have a centralized approach not only to defining projects but to tracking their progress. And, you know, we will track it enough and do enough risk assessments that my goal is to not have a project that 3 years beyond when it should have been stopped, people are saying, why did this go on for 3 years beyond when it should have stopped? So I think if we track them very carefully, we're going to be a lot more accountable. I have a personal opinion about some of these big projects that have a large IT component that you have to have IT very central to the delivery of that system. And that can be for something as simple as being able to gauge the skill set that a third-party vendor might be bringing to complete the project. If you don't have a knowledge of IT, you can't even make that assessment, which is going to make a difference to your project. So I'm pretty comfortable with how we're setting up the State Project Portfolio Office the way that we're going about ensuring that there's accountability for each one of these projects and how they're delivered.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Parnell, so then are you more of an advisory to the agency? They bring you information and you help them design that for them, or do they design and ask for help and are we doing it the right way, and you give the advice to say, no, it's not, that's not correct, or it's going to take too long, or you're going to get bogged down? What's the main role of your
commissioner? We're starting a new process because prior to this, you know, agencies were kind of on their own, and if they wanted to include IT, they would include IT. If they said, well, we'll let the vendor tell us what to do, that would happen as well. Our approach now, and the way that, in my mind, good IT projects are managed, is that you have IT talent representing the IT portion, and you have the business of the agency able to articulate what the outcomes are that they want. Then there's a translation process between what those business requirements are and how IT delivers them. So that's pretty standard for the IT world and for IT projects. It's very common. We work very, very closely with the agencies to make sure that they know what they want and we know how to deliver it. The third leg of that stool is the vendor. We do not, in general, have enough bench to be able to actually have developers in-house that can build these big, big systems. So we have a mechanism, and our project management is designed to have very close and constant communication between those business requirements that the agency needs, the IT that is going to satisfy those requirements, and the vendor who's got to understand what's being asked for. There's also relatively recent software development methodologies that we're starting to take advantage of. One of them is called the Agile software development process, which means that there is a sort of iteration of project definition that developers are able to check with you much more frequently than, say, another process. The old process of software methodology was called the waterfall process, and they would sit down with an agency and say, well, what do you want and how do you want it to work? So they would define all of that. They'd go off and build something, which might take a very long time, and bring it back to the agency and say, here, is this what you wanted? Well, no, not at all. So the Agile methodology has a much more agile way of revisiting what those requirements are. So you don't have the waste of time and effort that has been known to occur in the past with less agile processes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Commissioner, thank you for your work. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
You bet. Members, we're still at members. That's good. Thank you, too. Next meeting is going to be Tuesday, March 4th. Agenda is going to be State Auditor Review, Minnesota MMB Review, Veterans Affairs Review, Military Affairs Review, Admin Review, and a Capital Restoration Review. And those are probably the only reviews we're going to do this year, unless you have some other ideas. And any other questions? Thanks. Meeting's adjourned.